This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that change exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
This program has been edited since broadcast.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley. This is where true crime meets history with a twist on BBC Radio 4.
I was called to the Davis house, being told that Mary is very sick. She lay on her bed with her eyes partly open, barely breathing. She did not speak, and I could see but little life in her. The next morning, she was dead. Jenny Toppin had been caring for her all that time. Inquiries underway. Investigation of deaths of Cadomet family. Autopsies are performed today on the bodies, of which father, mother, and the two daughters all died between July 4th and August 13th. Miss Jane Toppin of Cambridge, a professional nurse, is the attendant on each of the patients.
I could have worked for years longer at poisoning if I hadn't killed four in one family almost all at once. That was the greatest mistake of my life.
This is Lady Killers, the series where ordinary women act in extraordinary ways. We're examining the wild and unthinkable crimes from history, supposedly committed by different murderesses from Britain, North America, and beyond. And we're looking anew at these stories through the eyes of contemporary feminists. Now, when you think of a nurse, you think of someone kind and trustworthy who'll take care of you. It's unimaginable today to think that a nurse would have anything but your recovery at heart. But this didn't stop this nurse 100 years ago from breaking the trust of her patients and committing the most deadly of crimes. This time, we're heading to New England, specifically to Massachusetts, at the turn of the 20th century. Our guest detective is Dr. Catherine Ramsland. She's Professor of Forensic Psychology at DeSales University in Pennsylvania, and she's written a book about healthcare serial killers, including our case today. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you for having me. I'm very pleased to be here with you.
Imagine four deaths in one family in just 6 weeks. How is this possible? And who is this unfortunate family? Meet the Davises, who are deeply embedded in the seaside resort of Cadomet in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. They run holiday lets, and that's how they meet the nurse Jane, or Jenny, Toppin. Every year, she rents a holiday cottage, although she doesn't always manage to pay the full fee owing. The first family member to fall sick during 1901 is Mattie Davis, the mother. After she dies, Jane, as a family friend and nurse, moves into the Davis' house to help them cope. Second to die is the younger daughter of the family, Genevieve, aged 31. Third, a few weeks later, is the father, Alden Davis. And fourth to die is the remaining daughter, Mary, aged 40. It's all a tremendous shock to the community, but it's considered to be a tragic coincidence. Really? What do you think, Catherine? Does that sound like a coincidence to you?
Does not sound like a coincidence. It's amazing that people didn't realize something suspicious was going on with this. That's too many people in one family to die so suddenly.
Well, we're not the only ones to be suspicious. When Mary, that final member of the Davis family, dies, her father-in-law, a man called Captain Gibbs, also has some questions.
After the death of Mrs. Davis, the rest of the family are all living together with Jenny Toppin. I was called to the Davis house, being told that Mary is very sick. We knew she was not a rugged woman, but still it is strange that she could be taken so quick and in such a peculiar manner. She lay on her bed with her eyes partly open, barely breathing. She did not speak, and I could see but little life in her. The next morning, she was dead. Jenny Toppin had been caring for her all that time. It struck me funny, but I said nothing and waited my turn.
Eventually, Captain Gibbs's suspicions prompt an autopsy. The bodies of the Davis sisters are exhumed and their organs are sent for testing. Now doubts are raised about Nurse Toppin, who'd looked after each family member before he or she died. So who is this nurse who seems to have become so much part of the family? Catherine, what do we know?
Well, Jane Toppin originally was born to Irish immigrants as Honora Kelly, and her mother died when she was young. Her father was an abusive alcoholic. She had an older sister, but the home was considered unsafe, so they ended up in an orphanage. Jane went there when she was 6 years old. She was there for 2 years, and then the Toppin family fostered her to be an indentured servant, which meant she lived there. She was given food, clothing, a place to sleep, and she had to work for it. So she was part of the family without really being integrated into the family.
This sounds like a terribly distressing childhood. And if this were a horror film, this is exactly the sort of thing that you'd expect the murderous character to have. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, I think she was from an abusive home. And on top of that, she was in an Irish family and there was a stigma to that. So they changed her name to Jane and she took on the name Toppin as well. So she kind of lost everything.
At this point, I'm feeling sorry for Jane, who decides to train as a nurse. Makes sense. It's a reliable profession that provides bed and board. It's a way for her to provide for herself. In the 1890s, nursing is still a relatively new profession. Earlier in the century, nurses weren't well respected. They had a reputation for being drunken and uneducated, and hospitals were mainly for poorer people. If you were rich, a doctor would visit you at home if you were ill, and ideally your unmarried daughter, if not any other available female relative, would look after you. It's only after the American Civil War in the 1860s that nursing starts to become a proper job, which requires training. To give us a better understanding of nursing in the 1890s, we travelled to Boston to meet Dr. Elizabeth DeWolf, Professor of History at the University of New England.
I'm here at the Massachusetts General Hospital Archives and Special Collections Room in Somerville, Massachusetts, with Dr. Karen Wolf, who is a nurse as well as a professor. We're sitting at a long wooden table that has several archival boxes. Karen, let's get started and find out what treasures are in these boxes.
Oh, fabulous.
We're looking at what appears to be a class photo, a large group of nurses in crisp white uniform sitting on the steps of a building, and it's identified as MGH Boston, June 1890s. Karen, can you pick out Jane Toppin?
I think Jane is second from the right on the bottom row. You can see all of them have their hair very tightly tucked under a cap, and she appears to be one of the older students in the group.
What sort of curriculum would a nurse undertake in the period in which Jane studied?
Jane had already had about a year of training at the Cambridge Hospital when she came to the Massachusetts General, so it's unclear to me if she went into the probationary period of nursing, but would often include much more the domestic skills, learning how to keep the hospital room clean, the hospital itself clean, making dressings. So it was really very hands-on kinds of care and a focus on hygiene in the hospital setting.
In the 1880s and 1890s, why would women go into nursing?
It was a profession that offered a certain legitimacy and guaranteed pay and guaranteed work. Typically, though, it was a work much like other kinds of work at that time that you did until you were married.
Were there any particular characteristics of women that made them particularly apt to be nurses?
You know, you raise a really important question, the question of nursing ethics at that time. It was really talking about what's a good woman. Mm-hmm. And to be religious, pious, if you will, to be caring, to be nurturing, a number of those characteristics were actually talked about as the core of nursing ethics. And that is quite a striking difference to what we talk about as ethics today. And so the notion of the good woman had a major influence over the selection of women for nursing.
So we have a profession of nursing that is merging the scientific practice of medicine with the domestic virtues and tasks of womanhood.
Absolutely.
Jane doesn't gain her certificate from the hospital because she violates the rules. She leaves the ward without permission. But she does complete her training and switches to practicing as a private nurse. She moves from house to house, living with and looking after the patients who hire her. And she's rather good at it. Throughout the 1890s, she builds up a reputation as the most successful private nurse in Cambridge. In 1901, she's living with a family in Wendell Street when her friend, Mattie Davis, pays her a visit. Mattie's come to Cambridge from Cantalmet to chase up the money Jane owes to the Davis family, and it's no small sum, $500. It's a hot day in Cambridge, and Jane invites Mattie into the house for a drink of water. It's after this that Mattie falls ill. And then, after a week of nursing, which her friend Jane readily provides, she dies. She's buried back at home in Cantalmet. And we know that soon enough, the rest of Mattie's family will follow her to the grave. After the four Davises have died, Jane does what she normally does, which is to find a new family to live with as a private nurse. And conveniently, she ends up a long way away from Cantalmet. But she's now under suspicion. And unbeknown to her, Jane Toppin is being secretly followed by a policeman, Detective Patterson. She's in New Hampshire visiting a friend when, at the end of October, the autopsy results come in and show that there was lethal poison in the body of the older Davis daughter, Mary Gibbs. On the 29th of October, 1901, Jane is arrested for her murder. Now, Catherine, that autopsy seems to have taken an awfully long time. It took from August to October. What was going on there?
Well, the autopsy itself wouldn't have taken that long. The body had to be exhumed first, so that is a challenge in itself. They would have had to take biological samples and tissue samples and test them. Even today, it can take weeks, even months, before you get the toxicology results from an autopsy.
How does toxicology work, Catherine? Do you decide what you might be looking for and look for that, or do you just do sort of standard poisons?
Well, these days, there's a standard list, but back in those days, they would have figured out, well, what's the substance used most often, which was arsenic, and that is what they suspected. So they would have been testing for that right away. They did find it, but the problem with it was that the embalming fluid also had arsenic in it, and no one could ever pin it on Jane that she had purchased arsenic. So back to the drawing table, they had to figure out what other substance might she have used.
And what did the further tests reveal?
The further tests revealed that there was morphine and atropine. Morphine is something that will put you into sort of a stupor, and atropine has more of an agitating effect. Jane, as a nurse, would have had access to any of the medications. She was experimenting on patients to see what the effects of these various medications would do, and she could actually figure out the timing of their death, because what she would then do is get into bed with them and hold them as they died. She wanted to feel as if she had total control over her patients. And it gave her a feeling of power, a godlike sense, but it also sexually excited her. That's how she put it.
Oh my goodness. So this nurse was using the drugs that were available to her to deliberately bring about death in a way that she had control over the doses, the timing, and she wanted to be present herself at the end of life. This is very chilling indeed.
Yeah, it is. Jane actually had acquired a nickname, Jolly Jane, because she had an outgoing personality and she was a good nurse. Often the healthcare serial killers are really good nurses and they seem to be very caring, but they do tend to have some motivation that makes them feel powerful. And I think when we look at Jane's childhood and the powerlessness she must have felt, even being fostered into a family where she's the servant, this is heady stuff for her to be able to be like a god in what happens to these patients.
I can see that this is partly personal to Jane and her background, but it's also at odds with this idea that nursing is a kind of religious womanly vocation. One of the things that's really disturbing and shocking about her. But today, Catherine, in modern life, how are patients protected against this sort of verging on a godlike complex that medical staff might develop?
Well, today we're more versed in the fact that there are such people as Jane. We now have laws in place for hospitals to be able to report any suspicions they have without fear of being sued. And we have training programs. I have gone into hospitals and talked to administrators myself about what kinds of things do you look for, because healthcare serial killers are the only subtype of serial killer that we can do what we call a prospective profile. That is sort of a threat evaluation, because they share a lot of red flag behaviors.
Oh, really? What sorts of behaviors are those?
Well, there's a whole list. But for example, they would be in patients' rooms where they're not assigned to that patient. They often like to hang around when a patient has died and listen in on their relatives' grief. And they will maybe be caught in the medicine storage where they don't belong. And obviously, one behavior alone is not going to be enough, but they have a number from the list. These are people you need to at least start watching more closely.
Gosh. This is fascinating. Have you in your own work come across people who behaved similarly to Jane? Jolly Jane.
We have a number of people who behave similarly to Jolly Jane. In fact, there's one, Charles Cullen, who went from one institution to another over a period of 16 years and murdered, by his count, 29 patients with 6 attempted murders. But most of the investigators think there are probably far more. Usually it was a time in his life when he was feeling depressed. Things weren't going well. He was losing jobs. His wife left him. And those are the times when he typically would kill patients to feel better, to feel more powerful.
Soon after Jane Toppin's arrest, more suspicions about these various deaths begin to come to light. Jane's case fills the local papers. There are portraits of her on every page. Dark hair, a little smile on a comfortable-looking face. It's easy to see why so many of her patients trusted her, because she looks so matronly. To find out more about how the newspapers covered Jane's case, Elizabeth DeWolf is at the Boston Public Library to search the archives.
The librarians have pulled some microfilm containing various newspapers. We're looking at the Boston Globe, the 1st of November, 1901, asks the question that probably everyone was asking, why? And the headline here suggests an answer: for money and revenge. And there's the motive, at least being put forth before her trial. It asserts that Jane told detectives she was innocent. So here we get a nurse pleading not guilty to murder. So clearly this is going to be big news. Oh, this one's interesting. So on the 20th of November, the Boston Globe is reporting that Jane Toppin has been in jail for 3 weeks, and she is still cheerful that the confinement in jail does not seem to be upsetting her.
So being in jail doesn't seem to be bothering her that much, Catherine. What does that tell us about her character? What's going on there?
Well, Jane has successfully manipulated people for years, so she has probably experienced something we call narcissistic immunity, the idea that they're the smartest person in the room. Nobody's going to get them. She is receiving letters of support from friends, from former patients who loved her, who believe that she's innocent, and so she's not worried.
Now, while Jane is being held in jail, a group of psychiatrists visit her to judge her sanity, and they decide to declare her insane. Catherine, do we know anything about the reasons these experts give in favor of her being insane, as they put it?
I think Jane was very confusing. For the male establishment at the time, there was the idea that women just had an inborn sense of nurturing and they would not ever be killing people in the way that Jane is being accused of killing. At the same time, the idea of insanity is evolving. And it's going from what we call medical insanity, or what we call today psychosis, into legal insanity, which is more of a cognitive appreciation that the person has a disease or defect that would prevent them from understanding that what they're doing is wrong or prevent them from being able to control it. So Jane had talked about a compulsion, and she doesn't seem to have any reason that makes sense for these murders, and she doesn't seem to have any real sense of the enormity of what she's done. So that kind of moral insensitivity or moral insanity is the way they understand this kind of person. It's what today we would call a psychopath. And the idea was that you're not delusional, but your behaviors don't really make any sense to us. Actually, Jane even said, I know what I'm doing and I know that it's wrong. But that didn't matter to the panel of psychiatrists because they decided that her behavior had no understandable motive, and she didn't have any real appreciation of the harm she had done. And so that, to their mind, was enough to decide she was insane and a threat to the community.
Jane's insanity diagnosis becomes known in April 1902. The trial, planned for the end of June, is expected to be short, and it is. After less than 8 hours, Jane is found not guilty by reason of insanity. But she is judged to be a danger to the people around her, and she is committed for life to the Taunton Medical Asylum. The papers go predictably wild for all of this. Here's Elizabeth again.
We have an overwhelming number of newspapers in front of us with bold headlines, killed 31 persons, reveled in agony, surprise in Taunton case, she is insane. People are grappling with the idea that someone in a trusted profession, nursing, a woman, is being revealed as a murderer. How could a woman do this? And if she could do it, could somebody else? And so as the press stirs up a frenzy, it's a frenzy that is eagerly embraced by a readership that is questioning, what is a woman? What are nurses? And how do they wander off a path into something as dark and as horrific as the murders that Jane Taunton committed?
Well, here's something that provides some insight into that conundrum. Jane actually made a full confession, which was published in a magazine.
I have poisoned 31 people as far as I can count them up and recall them. But there are more that I can't name. I killed them for various reasons, but it always gave me the most exquisite pleasure to see them die. I kill people because I want to get them out of the way, and poisoning is the easiest way to do it. I could have worked for years longer at poisoning if I hadn't killed 4 in one family almost all at once. That was the greatest mistake of my life. I know I ought to be punished for all these murders. I've made my mind up to being sent to an asylum, but I have hopes of getting out in 10 or 15 years, when doctors will say I am cured of insanity.
She just confessed to 31 murders. That, to me, is an extraordinary number. How did she get away with it for so long?
Because she knows nobody's really thinking that a nurse is killing. That's the first thing. Secondly, she always has a way to explain things that make sense for why this person is dead. And they didn't have really sophisticated diagnostic abilities in those days either. So it was easy to say someone died of cerebral hemorrhage or a heart attack or something like that. And so she just took advantage of it. She exploited all the holes in the system.
Now, in her chilling confession there, Jane Taunton says, "It gave me the most exquisite pleasure to see them die." What do you make of that, Catherine?
was she's an unusual serial killer in that sexual pleasure or thrill was behind a lot of what she did. And she gets into bed with her dying patients so that she can experience the death. In one case, she brought the 10-year-old son of one of her patients and held him as they watched his mother die together. And this was exciting to her. She found this to be the way she derived her greatest pleasure.
There's lots that's chilling and disturbing and upsetting about her, but this action of getting into bed and cuddling the patients, that seems like the action of the mother towards a child. So knowing that she's doing it for dark reasons, it's doubly disturbing, isn't it?
So I think with Jane, it was to feel the body changing and transitioning toward death and going cold made her feel like she's the one with all the power.
At the time, Jane escaped death by reason of this diagnosis of insanity, and she got sent off to the asylum. What do you think would happen to her today, Catherine?
Well, today, Jane would go to prison. It depends on what state she was in. I mean, we had a female serial killer in the nursing profession in Massachusetts, Kristen Gilbert, who killed patients in federal hospitals. So she did face the death penalty, but in the end, she got life in prison. I believe that is what Jane would most likely get because she was in Massachusetts.
So Jane, if she were alive today, would get a conviction for murder. She wouldn't get off, as it were, through an insanity diagnosis.
Jane made it clear that she knew what she was doing. She knew that it was wrong. All of that shows state of mind that we say is guilt. She's sane. She's competent to go through the legal proceedings. And she clearly made plans and experimented on patients. So she would be convicted of first-degree murder in all the cases where they had evidence.
Now, obviously, I feel sorry for the victims, but I also feel sorry for Jane Toppin's classmates, because we've got a new profession here. We've got women trying to establish themselves in this job, being taken seriously, being trusted by their patients. She must have damaged this new profession of nursing.
Jane definitely damaged the emerging profession of nursing, and especially private nursing, because anyone would then think, well, if she fooled so many people, who else might be doing this? So anyone who was in it would have found the Jane Toppin case to really harm them just by association.
Despite her wish to be released, Jane Toppin finishes her life in Taunton Asylum. She dies there in her early 80s in 1938. Now, some good did come out of the case of Jane Toppin. It was the catalyst for the beginning of the registration of nurses in the US in 1903. But this is a sad case, not least because it set back the development of the new profession of nursing. Care of the sick had traditionally been the job of your unmarried daughter. By 1901, you had the option of hiring someone to do the job for you. But Jane Toppin would have shaken your confidence in doing that. And while there's obviously been lots of progress since then, guess what? Care work, either low paid or not paid at all, still disproportionately falls upon females. Thanks to Dr. Elizabeth DeWolf and our guest detective, Dr. Catherine Ramsland. Next time on Lady Killers, we're joined by lawyer and comedian Sakisa Bostwick-Barnes to discuss our final cases in the series. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Hannah Fisher, and the readers are Laurel Lefcoat and Jonathan Keeble. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that change exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.